You're listening to The Stakes, KPFA's weekly deep dive into the races, issues, and power struggles shaping America's democracy. As the 2026 midterm elections unfold, we go beyond campaign headlines to examine the policies, court battles, voting rights disputes, and grassroots movements driving the national conversation.
The future is on the line. Democracy hangs in the balance. The stakes couldn't be higher.
It's Thursday, May 28th, 2026. You're listening to The Stakes. I'm Teresa Wersbianska. With the California June 2nd primary election just days away, it's go time for local Get Out the Vote activists hoping to affect change this year. We'll speak with Chaney Turner from Oakland Rising, Jason Negron Gonzalez from Seed the Vote, and finally with Aditya Bumbla, co-chair of the San Francisco chapter of the Democratic Socialists of America. All that and more coming up. You're listening to The Stakes on KPFA. I'm Teresa Wersbianska. The June 2nd California primaries are coming up next week, but first, big news out of Texas this week. Texas Attorney General Ken Paxton captured the Republican nomination for the U.S. Senate on Tuesday, defeating longtime incumbent Senator John Cornyn in a major political upset. According to results reported by the Associated Press, Paxton secured roughly 64% of the vote to Cornyn's 36%, a decisive margin of nearly 28 points. The victory came just days after President Donald Trump endorsed Paxton, praising him as a, quote, true MAGA warrior. Cornyn, who was first elected to the Senate in 2002, becomes the first Republican senator in Texas history to lose a primary bid for re-election. Here is Cornyn speaking at his concession speech.
But I believe, and I know my family believes, that public service is an honorable calling. Serving others is a high purpose. And while much about politics is ugly, we choose to serve through the good, the bad, and the ugly. Well, a scripture verse comes to mind as well, where the Apostle Paul said, I've fought the good fight, I've finished the race, and I've kept the faith.
The outcome marks another significant victory for Trump-backed candidates and underscores the growing influence of the MAGA wing of the Republican Party in Texas politics. The runoff is the latest example of Trump intervening in Republican primaries, particularly in contests involving incumbents who have at times broken with him. Cornyn has warned that Paxton could be a weakened general election nominee, arguing he would be a liability against Democratic State Representative James Tallarico. Here is Republican Senate nominee Ken Paxton on his opponent, Democrat James Tallarico, during his victory speech Tuesday night.
My opponent is the most extreme radical the Democrats have ever nominated. He's even running a vegan campaign, whatever that is. He goes by a few names that you may all have heard of. Some people know him as Tofu Tallarico. Some people call him Six-Gender Jimmy. I've even heard some people call him James Tallarico. And others refer to him simply as Low-T Tallarico. But no matter what you call him, let me tell you this. James Tallarico is a threat to everything we hold dear in this state and in this country.
Tallarico was quick to clap back on MS Now's Lawrence O'Donnell show.
Is this the campaign you wanted, Tallarico versus Paxton? Is this the opponent you wanted out of this Republican primary?
Well, Ken Paxton embodies the broken political system that we're running against. He is the most corrupt politician in America. 3 years ago tomorrow, he was impeached by his own party for using his public office, his position of public trust, to enrich himself and his donors at our expense. And that is exactly the problem in our politics. It's puppet politicians who serve themselves and their billionaire mega donors instead of serving us. It's why we can't afford anything. It's why we can't get ahead no matter how hard we work. The system is rigged by corrupt politicians like Ken Paxton. And so it's going to be all of us. It's going to be Democrats, independents, and Republicans. It's going to be urban Texans, rural Texans, suburban Texans. It's going to be all of us coming together, the people versus Ken Paxton.
Critics of Ken Paxton point to a series of ethical, legal, and personal controversies that have followed him during his time as Texas Attorney General. Paxton has faced longstanding securities fraud charges, impeachment by the Texas House in 2023 over allegations of corruption and abuse of office, and accusations from former aides that he improperly used his position to benefit a political donor. Opponents have also criticized revelations connected to an extramarital affair that surfaced during the impeachment proceedings. He has additionally faced criticism from domestic violence advocates over his support for reduced sentencing in a high-profile Texas child abuse case. The public policy poll of Texas currently shows Democrat James Tallarico leading opponent Ken Paxton 45-38%. Beyond the closely watched Republican Senate runoff, several other Texas runoff contests were decided Tuesday, shaping both the state's congressional delegation and key statewide offices. On the Democratic side in the U.S. House, one of the most closely watched Democratic runoffs took place in Houston's 18th congressional district, where incumbent Representative Al Green lost to Harris County Attorney Christian Menefee. Across the state, runoff elections also determined nominees for statewide offices and additional U.S. House seats, reflecting the broader reshaping of Texas politics ahead of the November general election, especially in districts affected by redistricting and shifting voter coalitions. In California, new polls are out in the governor's race. Three new polls suggest California's governor's race remains wide open just days before the June primary, with Republican Steve Hilton unexpectedly leading a crowded field and Democrats battling for the remaining top two spot. An Echelon Insights poll released this week shows Hilton at 25% among likely voters, followed by Democrat Tom Steyer at 18% and former Health and Human Services Secretary Javier Becerra at 15%. Riverside County Sheriff Chad Bianco trails at 12%. A separate Global Strategy Group survey paints a similarly tight race, with Hilton leading at 22%, while Steyer and Becerra are tied at 19% each. Bianco again polls at 12%. The Emerson poll released Wednesday shows Becerra leading with 20%, Steyer in second place with 19%, and Hilton trailing in third place with 18%. Pollsters say the numbers point to a clear three-way battle between Hilton, Steyer, and Becerra for the two spots that will advance to November under California's top two primary system. Other Democratic candidates remain far behind. Former Congresswoman Katie Porter and San Jose Mayor Matt Mahan each poll at 8%, while former Los Angeles Mayor Antonio Villaraigosa and State Superintendent Tony Thurman remain at 12% or lower. About 7% of voters remain undecided, with Election Day just 1 week away, underscoring the volatility of one of the nation's most closely watched governor's races. California Governor Gavin Newsom has signed sweeping new election security legislation ahead of the state's June 2nd primary, tightening rules around ballot handling, law enforcement involvement, and voter intimidation. Supporters say Senate Bill 73 is designed to protect election workers and restore public trust after Riverside County Sheriff Chad Bianco seized more than 650,000 ballots tied to a special election last year. The new law immediately bans law enforcement from accessing ballots or voting equipment without a court order and imposes penalties of up to 3 years in prison for violations. Scott Baba has more on that story.
California Governor Gavin Newsom signed legislation aimed at strengthening election security rules ahead of the state's June 2nd primary. Senate Bill 73 restricts law enforcement from interfering with elections by barring peace officers and law enforcement agents from accessing voter rolls, ballots, or voting equipment without a court order. It also gives the Attorney General and Secretary of State authority to block armed security at polling places. The law also prohibits mail ballot observers from challenging signatures already verified by voters and makes it a crime to remove voted ballots from an election official's custody. Violations can carry fines of up to $50,000 and prison sentences of up to 3 years. Bill co-author and Democratic State Assembly member Gail Pellerin said elections only work when there is trust in the system.
Election workers should never fear political intimidation for simply doing their job. Voters should never wonder whether ballots were improperly handled. And law enforcement powers should never be misused in ways that jeopardize the integrity of our democratic process.
The law follows Riverside County Sheriff Chad Bianco's seizure of more than 650,000 ballots tied to last fall's Proposition 50 special election. California Attorney General Rob Bonta later moved to halt the investigation amid legal challenges. Democratic State Senator Sabrina Cervantes of Riverside said the law would protect voter confidence and secure ballots.
We've seen an incident in my own home county of Riverside where ballots were seized and the chain of custody was broken. That is against the law. SB 73 puts in protections to ensure that ballots will be secured and that voters have confidence in our election system, that their voices will be heard at the ballot box.
Newsom said the law was partly a response to what he described as Republican-led efforts across the country and within the state to suppress voters and disenfranchise minority communities.
These guys are not screwing around. They're ruthless. So it's in that spirit that I'm signing this. Sober about what we're up against. Sober about the fact that acolytes for the Trump administration are actively encouraging ICE to go out, just as ICE did on Election Day last November. The BORTAC teams, Border Patrol and ICE, the morning of the election last November, big press conference near Dodger Stadium to intimidate free expression and vote. It was exactly what Steve Bannon encouraged and said you'll see more of. It's exactly what the new Homeland Security Secretary suggested he won't rule out. And that's why we have to step up and we have to draw the line. We have to clarify the rules of engagement.
Senate Bill 73 was passed on an urgency clause and took effect immediately upon signing by Newsom.
You're listening to The Stakes. I'm Teresa Wersbianska. A major Supreme Court decision still pending could reshape how millions of Americans cast their ballots by mail and potentially tighten deadlines in a way that voting rights advocates say could affect access to the ballot in key states. At issue is whether states can continue allowing mail ballots that are postmarked by Election Day to be counted if they arrive a few days later, a practice now used in roughly 15 states and Washington, D.C. Election officials warn that changing the rule midstream could force a scramble to rewrite voter instructions and adjust election procedures ahead of November. Supporters of stricter deadlines argue federal law requires ballots to be received by Election Day, while opponents say grace periods are essential to account for mail delays and protect voters who cast ballots in good faith. The court is expected to rule by the end of its term this summer, a decision that could have major consequences for close elections nationwide. Here is constitutional law expert Mark Joseph Stern of Slate Magazine.
This is a challenge to the laws in about 30 states that allow for the counting of mail ballots that arrive shortly after Election Day, so long as they were mailed by Election Day. And states determine that in different ways. Some use postmarks, some use something that USPS does now called optical scanning. Basically, there needs to be an indicia that it was, in fact, mailed by Election Day. These laws are really important. They actually have their origins in absentee voting by service members. This started during the Civil War. Service members were allowed to vote, and in many states, their ballots were counted even if they came in by mail after Election Day. That has carried through. A number of federal laws now allow for service members to vote from overseas, and most states allow those ballots to be counted even if they come in late, because, you know, mailing a ballot from a military base in Central Asia, might entail some delays, and there's a general consensus that the ballot should still be counted. And many states have expanded that to individuals who live within the state, including California, which has the most late arriving ballots of any state. And in the 2020 election and 2024 election, there were hundreds of thousands of mail ballots that came in shortly after Election Day that were still counted. In this case, the Republican Party is trying to nullify all of those ballots and to say that states are not allowed to count a ballot that arrives even a minute after Election Day. And its argument is that the federal statutes that set our federal Election Day as the first Tuesday after the first Monday in November somehow sort of implicitly require throwing out every ballot that comes in after Election Day. The court was receptive to this argument. It's going to be a close case, and it was a very sort of close call from oral arguments, how the court will rule. My suspicion is that the court will ultimately reject this argument against mail ballots, partly because this is really a huge, huge blow to election administration just months out from the midterms. I mean, again, you know, more than half the states have these laws. If the Supreme Court nullifies them all, it would be very confusing and cause a lot of chaos on top of the redistricting wars that the court has already sort of unleashed with its Voting Rights Act decision. But also, if this theory is correct, that there's only one day of the election, it would make early voting illegal. It would mean that everybody has to vote on Election Day and all of their ballots have to come in by Election Day. And I think that some of the justices on the right were very concerned about the kind of logical creep of this argument and just don't want to sort of open Pandora's box there.
That was the voice of Constitution writer Mark Joseph Stern from Slate Magazine. Here locally, voters across Alameda County are preparing to weigh in on a wide range of down-ballot races and local measures that will shape everything from housing policy and public safety to education funding and local tax priorities. To break down what's at stake in Oakland and Alameda County's voter engagement landscape, here's Chaney Turner of Oakland Rising, who has been working on local civic participation and voter education efforts across the East Bay. And Chaney will help us unpack what's on the ballot, where voter organizing is focused, and how grassroots groups are trying to shape turnout in this election cycle.
A few of the things that Oakland Rising is engaging voters around is, for one, getting out to vote, which is important. So we are doing voter mobilizations up until the election. But one of the measures that is very important that people support is Measure E. Measure E will provide funding for a lot of departments and entities that need to be supported. It will also provide funding for our 311 and other services to keep our neighborhoods and streets clean, and as well as a funding program that help our senior communities and low-income communities, but most importantly, for our public safety responses. So our 911, our fire department, which is vital I don't know if people remember, we had a huge fire in the Hills just a year ago. And if it wasn't for the additional funding that came in, we would have had fire departments that was closed. I'm really encouraging people to vote yes on Measure E. Also, we have Measure A, which supports our Peralta system and getting funding for our community colleges. As someone who's gone through the Peralta system and many people, we need to make sure that our community colleges are supported. And personally, I am voting for a district attorney for Pamela Price. She shouldn't have been recalled in the first place. She needs all the support that we can get. This current DA that replaced her is an establishment district attorney for the police. She's not standing up for the rights of victims, especially Black victims who receive the brunt of police brutality and harassment.
And for those tuning in, former district attorney Pamela Price is running against the current incumbent district attorney Ursula Jones Dixon. Do you have any other messages for Alameda County voters before they go out to vote?
Yes. If you have a mail-in ballot, please drop it off in person. I believe Tuesday was the last day that your ballot had to be postmarked in order to be counted. So if you're mailing off your ballots and plan to mail them off after tomorrow, you actually need to drop it off in person at one of our voting centers. There's a lot of voter suppression happening right now, and that is happening through our United States Postal Service, through the Republican Party, with Trump changing some of the rules of our Postal Service. So if you want your vote to count, we have many voting centers throughout Alameda County that you can drop your ballot off to make sure that your vote is counted. You can also find information on your voting centers. Just go to OaklandRisingAction.org, and we have a list of locations where you can drop your ballot off.
That was the voice of Chaney Turner from Oakland Rising. Local progressive activists from the Bay Area and the Central Valley are hoping to flip a congressional seat. Randy Villegas is running in California's 22nd congressional district with the explicit goal of flipping the seat currently held by Republican Representative David Vallado. The Central Valley District is considered one of the Democrats' key pickup opportunities in the midterms. Villegas, a progressive Democrat and community college professor from the Central Valley, is competing in the primary against Democratic Assemblymember Jasmeet Baines for the chance to face Vallado in November. National Democrats see this district as highly competitive after redistricting made it slightly more Democratic. Villegas has been endorsed by figures including Senator Bernie Sanders and Democratic Representative Ro Khanna. Jason Negron Gonzalez is the political director of Seed the Vote, a voter mobilization organization advocating for progressive candidates.
Seed the Vote is a progressive organization that mobilizes voters into tight elections, federal elections, to try to help our progressive candidates eke out tight wins in certain places, or in purple places, we often work to make sure that far-right candidates like MAGA candidates go down to loss. And we're working in the primaries right now in California 22 for Randy Villegas, which is a race we're very excited about.
Can you tell us a little bit about Randy Villegas and what is special about that race?
Absolutely. So Randy Villegas is running in California 22, which is a district that stretches from Bakersfield to north to a bit of Fresno. This was one of the districts that was redistricted in with Prop 50 passing. And this is a district that's been traditionally slightly Republican held. It leans Republican, and a congressperson, Valadeo, who's been very aligned with Trump, has been there in office for the last couple of cycles. We're excited about Randy because he's a working class candidate, born and raised in the Central Valley in the district, grew up with his parents, working in an auto body business, has worked as a teacher. He's a solid progressive. We feel like he's really well connected and is the right candidate for this district in this moment. This is going to be one of the seats that Democrats are looking to pick up in the fall. So we actually feel like he speaks really well to the issues and the experiences of people in the district. And he's additionally progressive, which I think would be a wonderful, a wonderful pickup for progressive politics in this moment, even though it's somewhat of a purple seat.
And if your candidate wins, what do you think are the implications on California statewide politics?
I mean, I think it's going to show that, you know, Democratic candidates that can hold progressive views and speak really strongly to issues in the community, which from the door knocking we've been doing in Bakersfield and Central Valley, are really bread and butter issues of affordability, you know, the cost of food, cost of gasoline, healthcare, like people struggling to make ends meet, that a progressive politics based on those issues is a winning politics right now in the Democratic Party. And there's some contention happening around that question. But I think this is the candidate that can really deliver on those issues in this district.
And how are you mobilizing both voters and get out the vote activists and volunteers?
Absolutely. So we mobilize volunteers nationally, but in California, we are saying, hey, this is a really accessible race for people all over California who want to throw in and see someone good take this victory in the primaries. Bakersfield is just a hop, skip, and a jump away from Los Angeles. It's not that far of a drive for those folks in Northern California. We're actually going to be doing some canvassing this coming weekend, final GOTV weekend in Fresno, which is about a three-hour drive from the Bay. So if people are local in the Central Valley, obviously it's very accessible, but even if you're in one of the more distant but large population centers in California, it's the kind of thing that you could reach with a three-hour drive or so. So if you want to find out more information about it, we're at stvote.org/doorknock. But generally what we do is we try to get people really set up well and prepared to canvass. We make sure even if people haven't canvassed before that they get all of the information they need to know to be able to feel prepared and solid on the doors. And then we knock good full day shifts trying to basically make as much contact as we can. So I think the last thing I would say is that this is a really, really tight race, which is part of why we're prioritizing it. And in particular, in Fresno, it's the second largest voting hub in California 22 in this district. There's about 9,000 votes up for grabs there for Randy. And, you know, there's still a lot of impact that we're having with the conversations we're having. This is not the highest profile race in California. So us being able to reach voters on the doors to make sure people know who Randy is and what he stands for. Every conversation we have with voters carries a lot of weight. And early voting starts this weekend, so we would love to have anyone out with us. This is a definite important race where we can have impact as progressives. And the canvassing is really what we're going to need to do to get this thing across the finish line. So we would welcome anyone to join us.
That was the voice of Jason Negron Gonzalez, who is the political director of Seed the Vote, a voter mobilization organization advocating for progressive candidates. Joining us now is Aditya Bumbla, co-chair of the San Francisco chapter of Democratic Socialists of America. They've been organizing around issues including economic equality, labor rights, housing, affordability, immigrant protections, and more. And they've been joining a progressive movement pushing for wealth taxes and broader structural reforms in California politics. Hi, Aditya.
Hi. Thanks so much for having me on.
So we are getting closer to the primary election coming up on June 2nd, and it's getting down to the wire for a lot of us who feel like we're kind of cramming for a test and needing to get all the info that we can. And so you're co-chair of the San Francisco chapter of the Democratic Socialists of America. And you all, the California Democratic Socialists, have dropped a voter guide recently. I was looking at it. It frames this election cycle as part of a new era for democratic socialism. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Yeah. So first, I want to clarify that there are a number of different DSA chapters in the state. And then California DSA is sort of separate from all of them in a way that they have delegates from different chapters across the state. And then they're putting out their stuff, but that might not necessarily represent the views of any particular chapter. But I can say that the California DSA voter guide, I mean, they put it out. We do sort of agree that that every election is fairly consequential for democratic socialism, and especially as I think you can see nationwide after the election of Zoran Mamdani our movement and our organization, our national organization, has risen to pretty great prominence relative to, you know, even a few years ago. So we're looking for every opportunity we can to push our agenda, to increase economic equality and you know, stop the billionaire agenda that's been hurting the working class in our state and our country.
A lot of people are talking about the governor's race right now, those seven top polling candidates. What does the DSA, and specifically your chapter in San Francisco, say about moving towards any endorsement for governor?
Yeah, I mean, our chapter, we're pretty clear on our lines. We only endorse socialists, and we don't see any socialists in the race. And so we are, you know, the Democrats, there's a wide range of Democrats. Of course, we're against all Republicans, though I hope that goes without saying, for socialists. But I think that there's a wide range of Democrats. Many of them are corporate-backed. One of them is prominently a billionaire. Funnily enough, who might have the most the best position on healthcare. But we as a chapter, we're not endorsing the governor's race because none of them are out and out socialists, and we're focusing on local issues. The California DSA voter guide, I think, points to Tom Steyer as a sort of pragmatic best choice. That's not a position our chapter has taken, but you know, it's a they lay out their reasoning, you know.
Yeah, for sure. And looking through the guide, and I want to move on from the guide in just a second. But yeah, there's quite a few no recommendation instances. What do you think that speaks to California Democratic politics and some of those challenges of building maybe stronger left wing alliances?
Yeah. So I think this is like the complication with electoral politics, right? There's a couple different goals that are sort of intertwined, but they're not always the same thing, right? One, of course, you want to pass policies that achieve your agenda. And for us, that's to help the working class, to build power for the working class, and you know, all the things that come along with it. Labor unions, immigrant rights, you know, solidarity with the Palestinian and working class, or the working class of people all around the world. But also, one of our main goals right now is to grow our organization. DSA nationally has about 100,000 members, somewhere around there. We had a little bit of a dip during the Biden years, and we're getting a big Trump bump and a Zoran bump since then. Our membership's been increasing. We want to do things, and especially this is a strong position of the San Francisco chapter, is we only want to engage in electoral politics such that we can grow our membership. We're not looking for any individual candidate to save us. We ourselves will save us. And if an election can bring people in, get people used to the political activities of knocking people's doors, talking to your neighbors, that is the skills we want to, you know, promote. But we're not, it doesn't mean we're just going to like rank the candidates and pick the best one if we don't think it's going to be strategic to our broader goals of growing our movement. So we want to make sure that if we're endorsing, we are doing so in a way that's going to be beneficial to the DSA. And then, you know, individuals are free to vote however they wish. I'm like, some of those races are no recommendation. You know, I have my own personal position on how I'm going to vote on those, but those aren't necessarily the DSA itself. If we're strongly endorsing something, especially coming from the San Francisco chapter, we're saying, hey, this is a good bet that like doing this will not only get the policies we want, but it's going to grow the movement.
That segues to the next question, and maybe you already kind of touched on it, but the DSA talks about, of course, building working class power rather than simply just, yeah, like winning elections for the sake of winning elections. What do you say success looks like for DSA this year in this election? I mean, even in races where your preferred candidates may not ultimately win.
Yeah, I mean, that's a great question. I'm glad you specified the time frame, because what does success look like? I can tell you, in the long run, it means a world without without people in chains, and a world of people of inequality. But I think in the short term, I think we're a little far away from true equality in the world. So I think what we're looking for is strategic points of intervention that where we can stake out a position. Say this is our goal, and then execute on that, right? I think for like stuff like the governor's race, I think the SF chapter feels like we're not in a position to, even if we put our thumb on the scale, we're not in a position to extract enough concessions from any non-socialist candidate. that it's strategically valuable for us to do to go on that. But there are plenty of ballot measures, local and statewide, that I think people are looking at. There are plenty of local races that people are looking at. Sometimes we might say, hey, we don't necessarily have a preferred candidate in this, but we might say this one particular person, we actually don't want to win. We'd rather have anybody else but this person win. And so these are things we're considering. And so we haven't taken any formal endorsement positions for the June primary yet, but our chapter meeting is on Wednesday, where we're looking to endorse potentially a ballot measure locally, potentially look into, we'll see about weighing in any sense on the congressional race. There's stuff on our agenda that might have us take some positions there, but nothing yet has been decided.
Before I let you go, I want to touch on a couple issues and some things we might see on the ballot. So California is seeing kind of the surge of these wealth tax proposals that are going to the ballot. What do you see as kind of, a core argument about whether to support these kinds of tax measures or not?
Yeah, I mean, I'll give you, I'm sort of, as a spokesperson for my organization, since we haven't taken a position, I will say that, there's that sort of org level neutrality we're taking at the moment. However, we all are agreed that we want to stop the billionaire agenda. I think, we have a billionaire president here in San Francisco. We have a billionaire mayor. We see, the Musks and Bezoses and Zuckerbergs of the world grow their influence over all sectors of our economy, of our social lives, of our, just the way we exist in the world. So I think there's a huge amount of anger and frustration from the people of this country. I mean, and this actually cuts across party lines. Billionaires poll worse than any party does. And so it shows that people all across the political spectrum are frustrated with the concentration of wealth and power in this tiny, tiny group of people. So while SEIU is putting this wealth tax on, I personally have some sort of questions on why is it a one-time tax? It's sort of an interesting structure there. Obviously, we want labor to do well in their political goals. In general, I think there's sort of there's that sort of argument about the wealthy will flee California. We see a couple prominent billionaires. I think Larry Page might have said he was gonna move, or Sergey Brin, one of the Google people, is saying that he's gonna leave California because of this. While we don't have a particular position on this tax, I want to be clear that when San Francisco chapter says we're endorsing something, it doesn't mean check a box, we're saying to recommend it. It means we're putting feet on the ground and we're knocking doors for it. And so we're which we have limited capacity to do. We don't do what's called paper endorsements. So if we're endorsing something, we really, really mean it. And we're going to put our money behind it and our time behind it. But all this to say is, even if we're not endorsing this particular measure, I think it goes to show how frustrated people are at just the level of influence the billionaires have. And it's no surprise that that people are putting this stuff on, and I think we're likely to see that go into the future as the wealth inequality continues to worsen in this country.
Yeah, and beyond wealth taxation, your chapter is also really focused on immigration, ICE,
absolutely.
Abolish ICE work, and taking that position on Palestine. How do you make that connection between local California statewide politics and taking a stand on that particular issue?
I mean, you look 25% of arms to Israel flow out of the port of Oakland. That's something that we're looking to combat. I think, you look at poll numbers in the last two and a half years, support for Israel on all sides of the political spectrum has dramatically declined. I think people are sort of realizing that the same surveillance technology that they're using on Palestinians is being used on us today. I mean, we have these billionaire funded, camera networks in San Francisco. We have all these data centers being funded, the same tools that are used by the United States military and its allies to oppress people abroad are being used at home. So it's hard not to see the connection. I mean, ICE, and their prison, I mean, their concentration camps are just sort of a, There's a first step towards a broader application of sort of martial law towards the American populace. You know, as I think the America's failed to achieve its goals in Iran and other places, it will likely take its frustration out on the American people. So it's hard not to feel like these issues are connected, right? The more we can build networks of resilience at home, that, you know, I can take care of my neighbor, whether they're undocumented, whether they have family in Palestine, whether they have family in Iran, the more we can take care of each other just in a general sense. I mean, I think that's absolutely crucial. And like, you know, some of the work we do, we accompany people into the immigration court. We make sure that, like, you know, we did so many protests and actions outside of one of the immigration courts. I mean, they shut it down in San Francisco, I mean, which is causing other logistical issues. But we go canvas businesses. Hey, you know, you can't buy, please don't buy Israeli products. Like, please put up the sign that says this is an apartheid free zone. Same way that people, you know, people organizing boycotts led to the fall of apartheid South Africa, you know, in the 80s and 90s. You know, people have a real hope that putting economic pressure on the American Israeli sort of military machine in Palestine is going to be is one way to show solidarity with the working class of the world. You know, elections, you know, they have this sort of this mechanism that sort of makes you feel like this is all that that politics is. It's voting every couple of years and then waiting to see what happens once you get the right people in there. But no, for us, politics is every single day. You know, it's where your money goes, who you're shopping, what you're doing, what the connections you're building. And so that flows into our election cycle. The more we can build connections with people now, like if we do run a candidate in 2028, or we do run a ballot measure this year, people be like, oh yeah, well, the DSA helped me out here. Like, okay, I'm willing to hear what they have to say on this more, you know, wonkish policy little thing. Or I'm willing to hear this person, you know, our former elected Dean Preston, he helped with getting tenants the right to counsel. So it's like, oh, well, Dean Preston helped me not get evicted. You know, I you know, this, and did DSA help me not get evicted? This is an organization that fights for me, and that's what we want to do.
Before we go, I feel like every time we talk about any race right now in California, people are like, who's our Mamdani? Who's going to beat the Zoran Mamdani of the California gubernatorial race or the LA mayor race? We might have to wait for that here in California. I don't know if you want to weigh on that. Do we have a Mamdani?
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think it's a great question. I think Zoran Mamdani is, you know, as any person, I have my, you know, there's things that I would say that he could do differently, but I think is pretty unique, or pretty clear that he is a incredibly talented, persuasive, charismatic figure. And he's come out of years of organizing by the New York City DSA. You know, it didn't come out of nowhere. It came out of a 10,000 person chapter that's been pushing for elections, pushing for ballot measures, pushing for just neighborhood stuff for years and years, and building that trust to build that apparatus that can push somebody. So if you're looking for a Zoran Mamdani, first you need the DSA. People know that DSA doesn't just mean there's a couple elected officials. It means that there's thousands of people behind them. People are intimidated by that. People respect that. Because the DSA means something behind our elected officials, and that was an impactful speech. I mean, he delivered it very well. But that's sort of what we want to do. Is like, it's not just the individual that's looking to save us. Like, no, it's the movement. We save each other, and then we elevate the right people to speak for the movement. But the movement comes first.
Thanks for joining the show, Aditya, and speaking with me today.
Yeah, thanks so much for having me on.
We've been speaking with Aditya Bumbla, who is the co-chair of the San Francisco chapter of the Democratic Socialists of America.
Coming up next, we will turn to our regular media literacy segment from Project Censored, the longtime media watchdog group focused on underreported stories, corporate media influence, and critical news analysis. Here are Mickey Huff and Eleanor Goldfield from Project Censored.
You're listening to the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm Mickey Huff with Eleanor Goldfield, and we are going to be doing a series of recurring discussions around the midterm elections where we're applying a critical media literacy lens. So we're going to be looking at the midterm elections and analyzing them, actually not just through critical media literacy, but multiple literacies, including historical literacy and civic literacy. And I see those things as all intertwined, right? As someone with a background as an historian and a social scientist that's also in media studies and media criticism and has long been promoting critical media literacy as a solution and an antidote for our mis- and disinformation sort of epistemic crisis we've been enduring here for the last decade or so. This is our inaugural conversation about this. Maybe we can talk about some of the bigger issues around midterms. And while it's probably more likely that Pacifica Radio listeners might be a bit more politically or civically savvy or media savvy because they're already tuning into independent community sources, they may already be aware that there is something outside the corporate media structure that masquerades as a mainstream view of opinions that's really just an, you know, upper middle class and oligarchic propaganda machine to get people to buy things. Candidates aren't much different, and the way in which that the campaigns go around them is like selling toothpaste. In fact, you know, many of the same marketing firms and lobbying firms that lobby or market around certain consumer products are also tapped and paid to spread propaganda around foreign policy or domestic policy and around elections, right? And so I think for our just for our beginning chat here in the next few minutes, maybe we'll talk about some of the basic things that people can be thinking about as a lens or an angle through which to look at midterm elections. And then maybe we can get more specific as we go along. But of course, the big elephant in the room, of course, is corporate media, the impact of lobbying, political action committees, you know, money in elections, post Citizens United, going back to 2010, the relentless horse race coverage that we tend to see in the media that doesn't focus on policies or what the public actually wants. They just kind of show who's ahead and what that, you know, what does that mean for the loser? There's a lot of things we can unpack here, Eleanor, but what are a few things just kicking off this segment that are things you'd like to alert people to when analyzing the midterm elections and media coverage?
Yeah, absolutely, Mickey. And I think, you know, you touched on the money aspect. And I think that a lot of us feel that, oh, well, I'm not going to fall for just whoever gets the most money, you know, poured into their campaign. But 100% of the people in Congress are the two candidates that spent the most money, right? Then that also feeds into the issue of parties beyond the duopoly, right? Why don't they get to where to Congress? Because they don't have the money. And I think that this also speaks to, we all want to think that we don't need critical media literacy. I know how to spot fact from fiction, but it is tailored in such a way to make sure that you don't. And this is not to say that you're dumber than. We're all susceptible because this, the propaganda has been refined. So I think it's really important to look into that money, see who is behind that candidate. Open Secrets does a great job of following that money. I think it's also important, as you noted, the history aspect, Mickey. You know, journalism is the first draft of history. How are we talking about the here and now that will be how we then talk about history? Milan Kundera wrote that the struggle of man against power is the struggle of memory against forgetting. What have we forgotten in recent history, right? What have we forgotten that needs to be pulled up and contextualize our current time? And that, of course, means the current elections. It's always the most important election, right? But yeah. What does that mean when we contextualize it in the recent history, particularly as we see basically every issue that is dear to our hearts being in the crosshairs of some serious attacks right now?
And yeah, the late great playwright and critic Gore Vidal warned about the United States of amnesia. I know we've certainly riffed on that before, but it's also hard to forget things we were never taught. And there's a lot to our history that we're not told or not taught, particularly around electoral politics, third parties, money, dark money, as you were just mentioning, which now plays a huge role in elections, along with lobbyists and so forth. It's really off the rails. And if you go back and look at the Princeton Northwestern study from 2014, that said that by the time you get to the federal level, the average American voter has zero impact on federal and national policy. And that study is 12 years old. And I mean, it was a good one. And I reference it often. It's to show that we do have our work cut out for us, but voting is important, particularly, I would argue, in local elections. So people should be paying attention across the spectrum, and they should be asking the questions about who wants me to see these messages, who's behind whatever the campaign is it positive or negative, to what degree are candidates ever talking about positions or policies? Do they ever get to answer to things in a meaningful way? Does the public ever get to interface with them? I think these are all things around the multiple literacies that we just introduced to people, Eleanor. And I think that over the series of this series, I think we can have some more specific conversations that look at them. But, you know, just for today and, you know, the first 5 or 6 minutes of this kind of a segment, I think it's important that we lay out the kind of things that we'll be discussing. And I'm looking forward, you know, over the summer to getting into some of these things in more detail.
Absolutely. And folks can check out projectcensored.org and, of course, all of our radio shows that air here at 1 p.m. on Pacifica Radio. But projectcensored.org has a lot of great critical media literacy tools that y'all can check out. A lot of them are specifically pertaining to elections. So until then, thanks for listening. We'll see you next time.
And those were the voices of Mickey Huff and Eleanor Goldfield from Project Censored. Before we go, I just want to remind everyone that Election Day is coming up on Tuesday, June 2nd. If you haven't already mailed in your ballot or made a plan to vote, now is the time to do it. Across California and here in the Bay Area, voters will help decide many important local races and ballot measures that affect housing, schools, transportation, public safety, and healthcare funding. So remember, every election, especially local elections, can have a major impact on daily life in our communities, and you can vote by mail. You can drop off your ballot at an official drop box, or you can vote in person at your local precinct. Be sure to check your county elections office for polling locations and ballot deadlines. Democracy works best when everyone participates, so make sure your voice is heard and be sure to vote on or before June 2nd.